So you can imagine the sense of urgency of this newly created, newly born, newly minted Plato's tribesmen who saw themselves as being the last great hope of establishing Plato's Republic. They had a plan. And even though tiny in number, to be single-minded in purpose and to aggregate resources to the achievement of that purpose moves mountains. They are tiny in number. We are huge. Single-mindedness of purpose will get us our freedom. There is absolutely no doubt about it. It is simply getting over the initial inertia, the pushing through the hump of 10,000 years of conditioning. But we gotta trust that earth in us speaks true. Continuing with Wallerstein, and obviously in all our future shows, we're gonna be fleshing out how to get over that hump, how to start taking those first steps, trying to develop a whole repertoire of options, things to do to get this ball rolling in a bigger way, in a way in which it cannot be ignored. And that we are, in fact, taking these conversations in myriad ways to the public, making them public conversation. Continuing with Wallerstein, the internal problems of Great Britain and France never became large enough that those powers could not concentrate attention on the geopolitics of the world system. And it was, I'm certain, pretty obvious to them that therein lay the solution to these internal problems. Continuing, the July Revolution, repeated and confirmed by the independence of Belgium and the Reform Act of 1832, was to have an immediate effect on Europe, whereas the relations of Great Britain and France between 1815 and 1830 had been correct, and those countries often found themselves on similar sides of world issues. The heritage of the two centuries' struggle for hegemony continued to ensure enough mutual suspicion to preserve a degree of distance. The July Revolution overcame that, affecting even the Tory government of Wellington before the Reform Act was enacted. Europe now entered the era of entente cordiale, a marriage perhaps not of love, but certainly of reason, one that would survive all subsequent quarrels, at least until 1945. And we discussed that when we read our excerpts from Savage Continent, that question of whether or not 1945 was had intent, how much intent to destroy a global organization for our freedom. It certainly achieved that. Continuing, the term itself was probably coined by Palmerston in 1831, although it did not come into official use until 1842. The geopolitical basis of the alliance, and he's talking about Entente Cordiale, the geopolitical basis of the alliance was clear. Quote, as a liberal power, France was, after the July Revolution, in the nature of things, the ally of liberal England. Unquote. Great Britain could now pursue with greater ease its containment of absolutism in Europe and expand the circle of liberal states. But there were further motives. Great Britain and France faced the same internal problems, and even if France was not yet ready to embrace the free trade nostrums of Great Britain, the Entente Cordiale seemed, in the eyes of Democrats and socialists, as an alliance of capitals that was a fait accompli. Was this so wrong? Indeed, the two effects were not separate. In pressuring other powers to follow their example, Great Britain and France, with the Entente Cordiale, discouraged the international revolutionary propaganda which counted on the divisions among the powers. Furthermore, 1830 launched a pattern that would discourage such propaganda even further. For France, at least, 1830 served to restore France to a sense of world centrality and nationalist pride. It was not Guizot, but the French socialist Louis Blanc who would write, quote, "The July Revolution was more than a denouement of a struggle against the church and royalty. It was the expression of national sentiment that had been excessively repressed by the treaties of 1815. We were determined to shake off the yoke of these treaties and restore the European equilibrium." Nationalism raising its ugly face, with folks encouraging it behind scenes always. Continuing, one of the curious facts to note about the July Revolution was what happened in Algeria. Charles X's launching of the imperial venture had made Great Britain most unhappy, and Louis XVIII was ready to sacrifice it to appease the British. When, however, the French restrained themselves from direct intervention in Belgium, they felt they'd done their share of pleasing the British and simply continued the occupation, this time without British protest. One reason clearly was its effect on worker unrest within France. The floating, quote unquote, population of Paris, the potential revolutionaries were being encouraged to settle in Algeria. Indeed, in 1838, Léon Blondel, a high civil servant in Algeria, could say with some confidence, "Africa is an element of order in France, most def." The liberal states then combined, legitimating the political role of the middle class and thereby receiving from them legitimation in return, and internal repression of working class discontent with an entente cordiale between themselves to ensure their dominance in the geopolitical arena. This seemed to work at first, but it was fragile, as the European Revolution of 1848 was to demonstrate. More would have to be done to secure a stable political framework for the capitalist world economy in the post-1789 situation. And my comment, again, as Hirschman suggests, a lot of megalomaniacal scheming can be hidden neath the ideology of an economy that never stops eating because of some supposed inherent logic of accumulation. And that is the angle we have been pursuing here. We believe that these tiny, tiny few are motivated not by greed, but, as de Tocqueville prophesied, by power, by being they want to be the only game in town when it comes to defining what the world is, when we are all locked up and safely disposed of, when they no longer have to worry about us because they got machines handling it all, and us in fear of literally being annihilated. That's the point of having secret weaponry. Continuing, the conservatization of the French regime contrasted with what was happening in the other liberal states. A liberal pope, Pius IX, had been elected in 1846 to the dismay of Metternich. If Belgium remained calm in 1848, it was because it had made its revolution peacefully in 1847. Similarly, the liberals and radicals had won their internal struggle against the Sonderbund in Switzerland in 1847 with the diplomatic support of the British, but amid French hesitation. Indeed, this was a moment of temporary breakdown of the Entente Cordiale. At home, the British had handled well the Chartist challenge, at the same time that Sir Robert Peel was steering through the repeal of the Corn Laws. And a note at the bottom says, materially, the repeal of the Corn Laws would protect the poorer classes in time of scarcity against any disastrous rise in food prices. Morally, it gave them assurances that, unenfranchised though most of them were, their welfare was an object of concern to an aristocratic government and parliament, such that the specter of communism passed them by as well. The crisis of 1847 provoked no revolutionary disturbance. Although the Irish had to pay the price for this. The Irish potato famine occurred just at the time of the debate on the corn laws. That the Irish famine became a ploy in the intra-conservative political game is clear from Clark's account of repeal. The traditional remedy for famine was to suspend the corn laws and open the ports. But Peel told his cabinet that if he did this, in the case of Ireland at this time, he could not promise to reimpose them, and a majority in the cabinet felt they could not support him in this policy on these terms. He therefore retired, but the Whigs could not or would not form a government. Peel therefore returned to office at the Queen's request and repealed the Corn Laws himself.